you know, you won't go there, nor will you go to this kind of idolatrous, polytheist. And when we talk about polytheist, we're not talking about, like, you know, gods, like
it's
statues.
It's like taking them for a god.
It's taking your own nafs, your own desires.
Yes, and tying them with...
your own desires as your god.
God.
Yes, because isn't this really the characteristics of Islam, of Western civilization?
Of course it
is. Is that your desire is your god.
Is your god.
And has to be... Serviced. Any way, which way is necessary.
Exactly. On that note, Dr. Mehdi Tarabi, I thank you very much for your insight into the Imam's words. Of course, they still resonate deeply in our hearts. And we hope to stay on Sirat al-Mustaqim, the true path that Allah revealed for us in the Holy Quran. And, you know, really to read the Holy Quran and its message and take it on board for what it really is, the ultimate goal is for the salvation of man. And it just leaves me to thank our listeners and to thank you, sir, as well. And wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace, mercy, and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Mohammed bin Salman is known for his ruthless character as the de facto leader of Saudi Arabia. An ambitious crown prince, he has purged the palace of his critics, thrown into prison political dissidents, and waged a bloody war on Yemen, contributing to one of the worst humanitarian crises in recent history. Yet the prince is not only preoccupied with politics, war, or bloodshed. As one of the biggest spenders in the world, Bin Salman is leading an inconceivable life, which the kingdom's oil wells have provided him with. He has splashed out hundreds of millions of dollars on super yachts, private jets, helicopters, French chateaus, rare paintings, and of course, private parties. In 2015, the world was left stunned as an anonymous buyer gave $300 million for a French chateau. At the time, it was recorded as the world's most expensive house sale. Only 2 years later, it became revealed that the generous buyer was Bin Salman, who had fallen in love with the Chateau Louis XVI on a work trip. Dating back to the 17th century, the property has 10 bedrooms, an indoor and outdoor pool, a private cinema, a squash court, 2 ballrooms, a nightclub, a library, and an aquarium. It also has fountains, a sound system, lights, and air conditioning that can all be controlled by an iPhone.
The members of the royal family, we spend outrageous amounts of money, typically on really quite outrageous things from an Islamic point of view, including prostitution, alcohol, gambling, very ostentatious lifestyles that include buying huge mansions in Europe that they never even visit. There's stories of spending tens and tens of millions of dollars to buy properties and keep them up without actually ever going to stay even one night in those properties or to use them to raise revenue.
In the same year, the young prince handed over $500 million, about double the original cost, to a Russian vodka mogul for his superyacht, one of the largest boats in the world. 2 years after his royal shopping spree, which cost him almost half of Donald Trump's net worth, the crown prince this time tried to present himself as a man infatuated with artwork. So he purchased Leonardo da Vinci's Salvatore Mundi for $450 million. He actually ordered the painting anonymously by phone. The masterpiece is said to be hung in Bin Salman's superyacht. Bin Salman's spending is not easily traceable, and extensive investigations might just reveal the tip of the iceberg. In September 2020, Bradley Hope and Justin Shack published their latest book titled Blood and Oil, Mohammed bin Salman's Ruthless Quest for Global Power, in which part of the super lavish lifestyle of the Saudi crown prince was laid bare. The book claims that back in 2015, the prince flew 150 models from Brazil, Russia, and elsewhere to the Maldives to party with a few dozen men from the Middle East. They arrived by boatload and were all allegedly tested for sexually transmitted diseases, STDs. According to the book, the prince reportedly rented an entire island for the party for $50 million. He also hired big names from around the world, including Pitbull, Gangnam Style, and DJ Afrojack, along with Jennifer Lopez and Shakira.
If we look at what they spend their money on, of course, there's all sorts of material, and it's terribly embarrassing. I mean, MBS himself preferred, unlike his father, life in Europe and France. He was something of a playboy, a big spender. His father was in America, worked with NASA. These are odd people, okay? And they spend their money basically like billionaires anywhere else in the world, throwing money, huge amounts of money, at things which, Islamically speaking, much more often than not, are considered haram.
Mohammed bin Salman is just one out of 15,000 members of the Saudi royal family, with wealth estimated up to $1.4 trillion, more than any other royal families, and nearly 16 times higher than the British royals, worth an estimated $88 billion.
What we also know is that only about 2,000 of those 15,000 members of the House of Saud enjoy power, that is political power, and what we would call extreme wealth. So that massive amount of money that the House of Saud has accumulated is actually distributed through not the entire family, but only about 2,000 people within the family. And those people enjoy, through the head of the family, who is the king from time to time, they enjoy absolute power in Saudi Arabia. So it's a bit of it's a misperception to think of Saudi Arabia as some kind of a democracy with a ruling monarch as the head of state. In fact, the system of government in Saudi Arabia is much more like the old feudal systems that dominated in Europe in the Dark Ages, with the royal family exercising absolute power, including the power of life and death over all of their subjects, and having the right basically to help themselves to whatever wealth the nation has. That's the Saudi Arabia that we know today.
This huge wealth comes from the kingdom's vast petroleum reserves, which supposedly belongs to the whole nation, but in fact is the Saudi royal family's property. King Salman himself is estimated to have a net worth of over $1 billion.
The Saudi monarchy is extremely wealthy. The Saudi monarchy in the 21st century plays a role in the United Nations. It is a member of the United Nations. And one of the pillars of the United Nations Charter is the fair distribution of wealth. So we are all on this boat together. I would like to see the Saudi monarchy distribute the oil wealth among all persons living under its jurisdiction.
The royal family is rumored to own several lavish residences around the world, including in Switzerland, London, France, and Morocco. In 2015, CBS News listed 10 luxurious perks of being the Saudi king. Inside the kingdom, the royals also have astonishing palaces. One of them is the Al Yamama Palace, with gold fixtures and fitting.
It is, of course, scandalous when there are people trying to make ends meet, when the monarch spends trillions of dollars in his own comfort, its lavish mansions and castles and boats, etc. So this, what it's needed is actually a return to the values, to the Abrahamic values of the Quran and of the Bible.
The extravagant lifestyle of Saudi royals, and above all, that of the crown prince, doesn't represent the lifestyle of ordinary people in the kingdom that have to struggle day by day in order to make ends meet. The bitter reality is noticeable everywhere in the kingdom, even in the holy city of Mecca, where slum areas are too vast to be hidden.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Michigan Congresswoman said the ICC has the authority and duty to independently and impartially investigate and deliver justice to victims of human rights violations and war crimes in Palestine. Says Brett Wilkins, a writer, in an article published under the heading, No One is Above the Law. Rashida Tlaib rips Biden administration's opposition to ICC war crimes probe of Israeli regime. Stay tuned for the details, please. Responding to the Biden administration's opposition to the International Criminal Court's investigation of the Zionist regime war crimes in Palestine, Representative Rashida Tlaib recently defended the probe while reminding the U.S. administration that no one is above the law. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. firmly opposes the ICC investigation while vowing to continue to uphold a strong commitment to Israel and its security, including by opposing actions that seek to target Israel unfairly. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price asserted that the same day that the ICC, of which neither the Israeli regime nor the U.S. are member states, has no jurisdiction over this matter. However, Tlaib issued a scathing rebuke of the administration position, tweeting, No one is above the law, and that the ICC has the authority and duty to independently and impartially investigate and deliver justice to victims of human rights violations and war crimes in Palestine. The U.S. should not interfere with its ability to do so, insisted Tlaib, the first Palestinian-American elected to Congress. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fadu Bensouda confirmed the decision announced early last month to launch a formal investigation of the situation in Palestine, including three major wars in Gaza that killed thousands of people, most of them civilians. Bensouda said that the court's decision followed the painstaking preliminary examination undertaken by my office that lasted close to 5 years. While vowing her office will take the same principled, nonpartisan approach that it has adopted in all situations. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Zionist regime's far-right prime minister, called Bensouda's announcement absurd and in a tactic often employed in attempts to delegitimize criticism of the Zionist regime policies and actions, undiluted anti-Semitism, he called it. Palestinian advocates, however, welcomed the ICC report while condemning U.S. opposition to it. Blinken is flat-out wrong on every point he makes, wrote West Asia region expert Juan Cole. The ICC is not investigating crimes in the Palestinian-occupied territories. Since Palestine, as a permanent UN observer state, is a member of the ICC and invited a court into its territory, the International Criminal Court has every right to investigate violations of the Rome Statute that took place in those territories. The ICC is not treating Israel unfairly, asserted Cole. It isn't unfair to investigate a regime for committing war crimes when it has actually, like, committed war crimes. Blinken already let the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia off without sanctions for murdering Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, he added. Now he is running interference for Netanyahu. He's quickly becoming the face of American hypocrisy, which only wants sanctions on Russians, who are rivals but never on officials from countries that talk nice about the U.S., he said. Blinken was not the only U.S. official to oppose ICC probe of the Zionist regime war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories, as he was joined by U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. In a phone call with the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu recently, Harris and Netanyahu noted their opposition to the International Criminal Court's attempts to exercise its jurisdiction over Israeli personnel. Last year, the ICC also approved a probe of U.S. war crimes, including unlawful killing and torture in Afghanistan. The Trump administration retaliated by sanctioning ICC prosecutor Fethullah Bensouda. The U.S. has always been criticized for ignoring the plight of Palestinians and defending the Zionist regime's war crimes.
The recent coup in Myanmar has taken the time back to 1962, when the military took control of the Southeast Asian country 14 years after its independence from Britain. Since then, the stage was set for military's power play until 2011, when Myanmar underwent democratic reforms and began parliamentary elections. The military junta seized power on February 1 and declared a one-year-long state of emergency after detaining the de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and members of her National League for Democracy Party, among other elected government officials. The military claimed that the November election, in which Suu Kyi's party won with a landslide, was rigged. However, the Election Commission nullified this claim, stating that there was no evidence. While the ousted leader is under house arrest, military commander-in-chief Minh Anh Hlaing has taken power. Despite public opposition, he attempted to justify the takeover by saying the military is on the people's side and would form a true and disciplined democracy. That is while the military junta says it wants to hold a free and fair election once the state of emergency is over. However, the country has lapsed into chaos since February 1 coup, sparking daily mass protests as well as global condemnation. The U.S. and the European Union are weighing up imposing sanctions against the junta leaders. The U.S. already has imposed some sanctions against some of the major junta leaders. Nonetheless, the military has ignored the international outcry and responded to the public opposition with escalating force. So far, 50 people have been killed and hundreds arrested during the military junta's lethal crackdown on nationwide anti-coup protests. Wednesday marked Myanmar's bloodiest day since the military takeover. The U.N. Special Envoy on Myanmar confirmed that 38 people lost their lives after security forces opened fire on protesters, demanding the return of civilian rule in the country.
Well, I guess nobody knows why, but my speculation is that they are the ones who hold on to the power at this moment, and they are very motivated by having the power, whether economically or running the country. So now, because they are taking over the country by force, and nobody wants to have the military run the country, and therefore people are standing up for their rights, and that is exactly what the dictators, the Burmese government junta, doesn't want it.
Since the deadly military crackdown on the Rohingya Muslims in 2017, Aung San Suu Kyi's government has faced international condemnations. Following that, the West's interest in Myanmar has faded, and now with the military coup and the bloody crackdown on demonstrators, Myanmar is further alienating itself from the West. Moreover, as a Southeast Asian country is currently grappling with the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic and the military coup on its economy, the U.S. and the European Union are considering imposing sanctions. That could worsen the current crisis in Myanmar and push it into an ally's corner, namely China. The U.S. has already placed sanctions on Myanmar and has condemned the junta leader's harsh crackdown on the protesters. Moreover, the EU has also come out and condemned Myanmar's military, suspending development funds for the country. Yet what is interesting is how the Southeast Asian nations have so far rebuffed U.S. sanctions, which, in their words, has given the generals a lifeline.
The most important thing that we also need to understand is that Burma is one of the countries where China invests most. So, for example, we're talking about the projects that are linked to the China-Myanmar Economic Corridor, which is part of the Beijing Big Belt Road Initiative that looped together a series of strategic ports, railways, and pipelines across the globe.
No Asian country has come out supporting the sanctions and anti-Myanmar actions. In this instance, China can therefore benefit economically from Myanmar, as trade with the West is now restricted.
The volatile situation in Iraq has become a major headache for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. It is largely a legacy from Trump's tenure, which was marked by chaotic policies and dangerous decisions in the region. Biden came into office amid rising anti-American sentiments in Iraq and growing calls on Washington to pull out all American forces from Iraq. Biden's team is now faced with growing attacks on American and U.S.-led foreign forces there. Does the problem have a military solution? Despite Biden's promises of change, the White House must still be thinking that it does. Because last week, Biden ordered airstrikes on anti-Daesh resistance groups on the Iraqi-Syrian border in what his team described as a retaliation for earlier rocket attacks against American and U.S.-led forces. The U.S. airstrikes drew condemnation from resistance fighters and pledges of retaliation. On Wednesday, a barrage of rockets was fired at the Ain al-Assad Air Base, housing American troops in Iraq's western Anbar province. Advanced air defense systems at the Ain al-Assad Air Base failed to intercept the incoming rockets. Some observers believe the aerial bombardment ordered by Biden has backfired and has made U.S. forces in the region less safe.
It backfired because it was despicable and this was seen throughout the region. Everyone sees that America's just dumping its garbage on other people's heads. So it's very bad for the whole region if, in America's terms, because it increases anti-American sentiment everywhere.
Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq are nothing new. Anti-Americanism in Iraq was fueled by the devastating U.S. invasion of the country in 2003. Iraqis were infuriated by U.S. forces' attack on civilian areas and their horrific crimes in the years that followed the invasion. But the latest wave of hatred of America perhaps began in early 2020, when the U.S. military assassinated Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror icons near Baghdad's airport. Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis played a key role in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. The assassination triggered the Iraqi parliament to vote days later to expel all U.S. forces.
The Iraqi parliamentarians almost unanimously voted to expel all U.S. troops, period. And, of course, nothing has been done on that. So if a year ago the sentiment was like that, then it's only increasing. America is the enemy. America doesn't seem to get it through its head how it's perceived in Iraq and Afghanistan, wherever in the world.
but America is still refusing to heed to that call. It has instead deployed more military hardware and missile systems to Iraq in a bid to protect American forces. Such advanced systems have failed to make U.S. bases safe, with rockets still landing on them. The U.S. usually says such attacks are carried out by what it calls Iranian proxy groups. But Tehran insists that it has no proxies, but it has friends in Iraq. Many Iraqi leaders, political parties, and military groups in Iraq are friendly to Iran. Their ties grew stronger when Iran helped Iraq defeat the Daesh terrorist group. Last year, Trump withdrew several hundreds of U.S. troops from Iraq, but a much larger number still remain there, despite his pledge to end American military presence in the region. How will Biden deal with the situation now? Observers believe by ordering the recent aerial bombardment on the Iraqi-Syrian border, he definitely had a bad start. If Biden stays on the same dangerous course, he risks further destabilizing Iraq and broader clashes with resistance groups.
Yemen has recently been the scene of deadly clashes between Ansarullah fighters and forces loyal to the former president Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi, who aimed to capture the strategic northern city of Ma'arib. The fighting left at least 60 people dead on both sides Saturday. This after army forces and allied fighters continued with their push towards the oil-rich city, Hadi's last urban stronghold in Yemen, which is some 120 kilometers east of the capital Sana'a. Reports said that a high-ranking pro-Hadi military commander from Ma'arib's provincial military police also got killed. But last Friday was the bloodiest day since the start of the offensive on February 8. More than 60 people died in that fighting. Reports said the dead included at least 27 pro-Hadi militias. Meanwhile, on Saturday, several civilians, including a child, got killed in a Saudi-led airstrike in Yemen's western province of Hodeidah. The Yemeni media said that a drone raid targeted a residential building in the city of Hodeidah, also injuring several others.
The war being waged by the Saudi royal family against the people of Yemen, which is the poorest country in the Arab world, is an illegal war. It's a war of aggression, and it's also illegal in the targets that it takes in Yemen. 233,000 people are reported to have been killed. These are civilians who have been killed by Saudi air attacks. And a child dies every 10 minutes, according to UNICEF, in Yemen due to hunger and to lack of medications. And that's because the Saudis are illegally blocking aid coming into the port of Hodeidah. So everything about this war is illegal.
The attack comes as the sixth anniversary of the Saudi invasion of Yemen is near. The conflict has killed hundreds of thousands of people and displaced millions. It has also reduced to rubble much of Yemen's infrastructure. The United Nations has described the situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UN's humanitarian agency has warned that more than 16 million people in Yemen will go hungry this year as Saudi Arabia presses ahead with this notorious war. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said that half a million Yemenis are already living in famine-like conditions. It said the risk of large-scale famine has never been more acute than now. According to the agency, years of conflict have created enormous humanitarian needs in all sectors.
The famine caused by the Saudi war on Yemen is part of the illegality of the war in general. It's been caused because the Saudis have been blockading the ports of Yemen, especially Hodeidah, and preventing international aid from coming in, aid that has been mandated through the United Nations and agreed to by the parties at international conferences. But that doesn't stop the Saudi coalition from trying to starve the people of Yemen into submission.
The UN says that at least 60% of Yemenis are food insecure, and 16 million people do not have access to safe water and proper sanitation. The war impact, compounded by the blockade and the coronavirus pandemic, has battered Yemenis. But all of this would not have happened from the beginning if the U.S. and its allies had not provided logistical military support and military hardware to Saudi Arabia.
It's shameful that the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, Italy, and other countries have been selling large amounts of arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies, such as the UAE. These arms have allowed the Saudi coalition to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen and to cause widespread death and famine.
The Biden administration says it plans to stop arms sales to the Saudis and to stop supporting their war in Yemen. Many would consider this move as too little too late, because Riyadh has already packed its arsenal with huge quantities of arms that it bought from the previous administration and other Western governments, especially the UK. But almost 6 years into the war, the Saudis are facing an impasse, as they have not made any significant gains on the battlefield. They have suffered many humiliating blows from the Yemenis who, unlike their enemy, have stood their ground. The latest attack on Riyadh is one example. What the people of Yemen want to see at a minimum is a meaningful move by the West and the UN to effectively end this war that will go down in history as a war in which the U.S. backed the Saudi-led coalition and committed war crimes in that country.
The world will never forget the gruesome assassination of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The outspoken critic of the Saudi regime was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Shortly after the killing, the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency assessed with high confidence that Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, had personally ordered the assassination. The case turned into a severe political storm, triggering global condemnation of the Saudis. However, then U.S. President Donald Trump chose to stand with the notorious Crown Prince and rejected calls to condemn him. Trump's White House dismissed intelligence that bin Salman personally ordered the killing. The former American president made no secret of what was behind his unrelenting support for bin Salman. Trump stressed that he did not want to sacrifice billions of dollars in U.S. arms sales to Saudi Arabia over the matter. The previous U.S. administration blocked the release of the intelligence community's findings into the killing. Trump's successor, Joe Biden, is apparently taking a different course. Biden said during a presidential campaign rally that Khashoggi was murdered and that he believes the Crown Prince ordered the hit. His administration is now releasing a declassified version of a top-secret intelligence report that singles out the Saudi Crown Prince for at least giving the go-ahead for the assassination, if not directly ordering it. Biden has pledged to take a tough line on Saudi Arabia's human rights violations and its war on Yemen.
Biden, I think, is signaling MBS and the world that the United States is getting back on board as a leader in diplomacy, as a world leader. And you're not going to be those things if you're led around the world by the nose by a Saudi feudal prince. That's got to change. Didn't change under Trump. Didn't change under Obama. I hope to see Biden change that.
The new U.S. administration has made some policy changes regarding Saudi Arabia. U.S. President Joe Biden has ended American support for offensive operations in the Saudi-led war in Yemen and has freezed the sales of weapons to the kingdom. These are not looking very bright for the relationship between the two allies, at least for now. The release of the report on the assassination of Khashoggi is expected to further strain the ties between the two sides. However, during a call with the Saudi king on Thursday, Biden told Salman that he would work for bilateral ties as strongly and transparently as possible. Biden and top administration officials have stressed that they are committed to Saudi Arabia's security. Biden has been in office for a little more than a month, and it is definitely too soon to judge his decisions. The Saudi kingdom is right now a major foreign policy dilemma for the White House. Even if Biden is willing to punish the Saudis for their rights violations and destabilizing actions like their war in Yemen, the road ahead for him will be very bumpy. This is because the kingdom is a long-standing U.S. ally with many powerful friends in Washington. Meanwhile, Saudi petrodollars will definitely not be easy for the Americans to resist.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. The limelight. U.S. Democrats and some civil rights leaders applauded the passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act of 2021 in the House of Representatives recently as an important step towards curbing police violence. However, the suite of policing reforms does not reflect the transformational demands of the movement that erupted into view after police killed Taylor, Floyd, Daniel Prude, Tony McDade, Modesto Reyes, Patrick Lynn Warren, and so many others. We now present you an article written by Mike Ludwig. The piece is called, "The U.S. House Passed a Bill Named for George Floyd. It Won't Stop Police Killings." The article has been published by truthout.org website. Please stay with us for more of Mike Ludwig's article. George Floyd grasped for breath under the knee of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, another police officer turned to the gathering crowd and said, "This is why you don't do drugs, kids." Days later, Derek Chauvin's attorneys told the judge that prosecutors had no probable cause to charge Chauvin because George Floyd tested positive for drugs and had medical conditions. Blaming the victim, a common practice particularly when the victim is black or brown, attorneys postulated that George Floyd had overdosed and caused his own death. two separate autopsies would confirm that Derek Chauvin killed George Floyd, but only after Chauvin's lawyers spread the dehumanizing notion that George Floyd's alleged drug use made him unworthy of living. Breonna Taylor, whose name was chanted with George Floyd's at the protests against police perpetrated violence swept the country last year, was killed by police officers during a botched drug raid in March of 2020. No drugs were found at the home in Louisville, Kentucky, where Breonna Taylor, a black medical worker and aspiring nurse, was gunned down. But prosecutors argued the plainclothes officers who busted inside were justified in their use of force. A grand jury agreed, and charges against the police officers were dropped. Democrats and some civil rights leaders applauded the passage of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act of 2021 in the House of Representatives recently as an important step towards curbing police violence. However, the suit of policing reforms does not reflect the transformational demands of the movement that erupted into full view after police killed George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Daniel Prude, Tony McDade, Modesto Reyes, Patrick Lynn Warren, and so many others. Activists envision reducing, defunding, and ultimately eliminating policing, whilst redirecting police funding to meet community needs. In contrast, the police reform bill would give police officers more money in the form of grants that theoretically act as an incentive to adopt modest reforms, if local cops even want the funding. Congress would continue supporting the war on drugs, which looms as one factor behind the deaths of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Modesto Reyes, and so much of the violence that people of color and particularly black people face at the hands of police officers. Maritza Perez, National Affairs Director for the Drug Policy Alliance, a group that lobbies Congress to abolish the drug war, said the bill passed by the House recently falls far short of the kind of reform and accountability that is needed to end police violence in America. House Democratic leader Maritza Perez said, fast-track version of the bill that passed last year before dying in the Senate, rather than listening to concerns raised by racial justice groups and members of ultra-police communities. Perez said in an interview, last year we raised at various times whilst this bill was being put together, and it didn't go far enough. And the way that the Democrats are explaining this bill even isn't accurate. The Justice in Policing Act, which faces Republican opposition in the Senate, would prohibit racial profiling by police officers. But proving racial profiling has taken place is a difficult process. The bill aims to create new training programs for cops and make it easier to hold police officers accountable. But similar attempts at police reform at the local level have not prevented police-perpetrated violence. With African-American people three times as likely to be killed during an encounter with police than whites, and law enforcement's continued focus on drug enforcement in communities of color, critics say the House bill will not prevent more deaths. Erica Mayer, Deputy Senior Director of Criminal Justice and Democracy Campaigns at the civil rights group, Color of Change, in a statement said, the bill continues the misguided logic that more police equals more safety and better protections of human rights. Standards and training have not been shown to have a profound effect on police-perpetrated violence. Activists argue that policing is inherently violent and racist, and only reducing and ultimately abolishing policing can reduce police violence. For example, the bill would prohibit federal law enforcement officers from putting people in chokeholds and serving no-knock warrants, two policing tactics that are notorious for causing serious harm. However, the bill would not stop local and state police from using chokeholds and no-knock warrants. Instead, it uses federal funding as an incentive for local cops to adopt federal standards and training. Besides, George Floyd was killed by blunt force trauma and asphyxiation from a knee to the neck, not a chokehold. As Derecka Purnell points out at The Guardian, the Justice in Policing Act would not have saved George Floyd's life. It may not have saved Breonna Taylor's either. No-knock search warrants involve police or a SWAT team barging into private property unannounced, most often to search for drugs inside a home, and are blamed for numerous injuries and deaths. Maritza Perez said the Justice in Policing Act does not prohibit quick-knock raids that can be just as deadly. During a quick-knock raid, which are also often used to serve drug warrants, police officers simply knock before they burst into your home. In Breonna Taylor's case, police officers told investigators they repeatedly knocked and announced themselves before breaking down the door with a battering ram. Other reports indicate that there was no warning at all. Breonna Taylor was in bed with her boyfriend, who reportedly thought they were being robbed. He pulled a gun and fired one shot. Police officers responded with a hail of gunfire. In the wake of Breonna Taylor's death, Louisville banned no-knock warrants and set new guidelines for police raids. Even if Congress passes the Justice in Policing Act, states and localities would be left to pass their own reforms, as a few are already doing. Marisa Perez said, a lot of these problematic policing practices, a lot of cases that we hear about where people are killed, are derived from drug investigations, or drugs are used as a pretext to question somebody and have that initial interaction. Democrats say the House bill would limit the transfer of military-grade equipment to local police departments, but Maritza Perez said the legislation would not end the practice outright. The war on drugs has long been used to justify the militarization of police forces, with heavily armed SWAT teams busting into homes in the middle of the night and deploying smoke bombs and flash grenades. In 2014, a flash grenade critically injured a toddler during a no-knock drug raid in Georgia. Activists have long called for an end to federal programs that transfer military equipment to local police officers, especially after the 2014 uprising in Ferguson, Missouri, where military equipment was used against the protesters after a police officer shot and killed Michael Brown. Federal programs that transfer military equipment to cops would be curtailed under the House bill, as they were during the Obama administration, but the programs would not be shut down. Maritza Perez said, most often when we say militarized police, it's in the course of a drug investigation. U.S. police officers are notorious for getting off easy, even after they kill people, and mainstream civil rights leaders such as Reverend Al Sharpton of the National Action Network say national reforms like the George Floyd Act are necessary for pushing justice at the local and state level. However, Republicans remain opposed to the qualified immunity proposal and other changes, posing a major hurdle in the Senate, where Democrats must convince 10 Republicans to support the bill or end a filibuster to pass it. Maritza Perez said both Democrats and Republicans are mischaracterizing the bill, with Democrats claiming it goes much further than it actually does, and Republicans falsely claiming it would defund the police. Perez said, I really don't think this bill provides real accountability.
Joe Biden's first military action as president of the United States was to bomb Syria, cementing himself as another warmonger in the Oval Office. The claim that these strikes were defensive in nature is an absurdity coming from an occupying force, which most seem to gloss over. This was a violation of Syria's sovereignty and territory and another act of imperialist aggression. So let's break this down. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On February 25th, 2021, the United States bombed the Syrian Arab Republic. The airstrikes took place on the border between Iraq and Syria, around Abu Kamal, located in the Deir ez-Zor province in eastern Syria. According to the Syrian Arab News Agency, four were wounded and one person was martyred. Shortly after the attack, the Pentagon released a statement saying, quote, at President Biden's direction, U.S. military forces earlier this evening conducted airstrikes against infrastructure utilized by Iranian-backed militant groups in eastern Syria. These strikes were authorized in response to recent attacks against American and coalition personnel in Iraq and to ongoing threats to those personnel. Specifically, the strikes destroy multiple facilities located at a border control point used by a number of Iranian-backed militant groups, unquote. So this statement claims that these strikes were defensive, which is an absurdity in of itself. Syria has not bombed the United States or declared war on the United States. Syria is on the other side of the planet. The United States has no business being in Syria. Moreover, the claim that they were meant for de-escalation simply does not compute. Bombing another country is tantamount to a declaration of war, not de-escalation. China, Venezuela, Iran all condemned the attack, and Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman, Maria Zakharova, strongly condemned the bombing and called for unconditional respect for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria, which should not be used to settle geopolitical scores. So according to the Biden administration, this attack on Syria was a response by the United States to recent attacks on its personnel. Now, it's widely assumed by the media that what they're referring to is a rocket attack that took place on February 15th in Erbil in Iraq, where an American contractor was killed. Six others were wounded, including an American soldier. And in another instance on February 22nd, when a rocket landed inside the Green Zone in Baghdad. This is where the U.S. Embassy is located, the biggest embassy in the world, almost the size of Vatican City, which looks more like a military installation than anything else. So while the United States claims it's defending itself and responding to rocket attacks, it conveniently leaves out the obvious that the United States is in Iraq illegally. It illegally invaded Iraq in 2003, along with Britain. The U.S.-led coalition has no right to be in Iraq in the first place, nor in Syria for that matter. So you can't talk about defending yourself when you are the aggressor, when you are the oppressor, when you are illegally on someone else's land. You're not defending yourself when you're on someone else's land. You are attacking. Moreover, the United States has imposed crippling sanctions on Iran, which are indeed a form of siege warfare. It assassinated General Soleimani. It has violated Iran's sovereignty numerous times. But the U.S. is not officially at war with Iran, so why is it bombing Iranian-backed militias? Is that supposed to make it okay? When the U.S. talks of Iranian-backed militias, what they really mean are the Popular Mobilization Forces, the PMU, or in Arabic, the Hashd al-Sha'bi. These are not Iranian troops. They're a popular resistance movement made up of various local ethnic religious groups, which include Shia, Sunni, Christians, Druze, but fought very hard to defeat Daesh and to resist occupation. But of course, the United States can't speak of them as a popular resistance because then people would rightfully wonder, what are they resisting? And this would expose the United States and their allies as illegal occupiers, as an invading force, which has no right to be there in the first place. As long as a Pentagon official or a stenographer for the White House says Iran or Iranian-backed militias, that's all it takes for everyone's brains to suddenly shut down and just accept that Joe Biden is bombing another sovereign nation. First of all, whether Iran has troops or militias, as they say in Syria, or the other way around, this is a matter between Iran and Syria. The United States has no right to interfere in the eternal politics, alliances, partnerships, and cooperations between those two countries. Would the United States accept it if, for example, Syria bombed Korea for having an American base there? Of course not. So this is not a valid argument. Syria is a sovereign nation, Iran is a sovereign nation, Iraq is a sovereign nation. But of course, this is of no concern to the Americans and British who have colonized the region for centuries, plundering and stealing resources and meddling in the region's political affairs. Donald Trump assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's